Hello, and welcome to the History is Fun podcast. I am your co-host, Stephen.
And I am your not-as-successful-as-Stephen co-host, Anthony.
Well, Anthony, it's been a bit.
It has. It's been a minute since we've done this, and I've missed it because I enjoy talking to you, and I enjoy history.
I have. I've missed it as well, and I know that as we release these episodes, we've got a little bit of kind of a time distortion where we're going to release one where, you know, we're all kind of chatting like normal, like it's, you know, normal week. And then this episode is going to come out after that. And it's going to be like, hey, we haven't talked to each other for a while. That's because we've had a couple things happen the past week. You know, school's been getting started and that's just a busy time anyway. But we've got a couple of episodes kind of in the backlog that we are kind of like throwing in here and there. So that's why if we say something in some of these episodes that kind of like doesn't make sense in chronological order, It's because of that.
It's because it's not
in chronological order.
Yeah. I know this is history, so let's not get hung up on, you know, timelines. Because timelines aren't important. Right?
I have a game called Timeline that I like to play with my students sometime. It's a card game, and there are historical events on probably about 150 cards or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the students have a reference card that they all start off with, and they go around and they hold their cards so that they can't see the dates, and they have to try and figure out if their card that they're playing happened before or after the reference card, the card that's down on the table. And if they are right, if they're correct, they don't have to draw a card. If they are wrong, they have to put it in the right place and then draw a card, and it goes around in a circle. And it's easy at first because you may start off with like the invention of gunpowder, and one of your cards may be the extinction of the dinosaurs, and boom, you can put that down. That's easy. But like when it gets to like what came first, the invention of champagne or the invention of the baguette, it can get kind of tricky.
That sounds cool. That needs to be something that I steal from you for next year when I teach world history, or next semester when I teach world history for the first time. And whenever I need so we have like club days at our school once a month where we're not supposed to add new information. So that sounds like a fun club day activity where we're still doing something productive, but not necessarily doing anything that kids will miss.
Yeah. And it's really fun to play. The kids, they're kind of skeptical about it at first, but my kids always get into it and they really like it, and it is really good kind of as a review, especially if you are doing a world history, because it's all sorts of world events throughout history.
That's awesome. All right, Stephen, well, what did you learn this week?
Well, what I learned this week, and I'm going to be honest, it's kind of a crappy thing that I learned, but you know Lewis and Clark, you know, our good pals Meriwether Lewis and William Clark.
Yeah, man. What about our explorer?
So I was reading an article this week talking about how historians and scientists were able to track the route of Lewis and Clark extremely accurately. And do you want to take a guess as to how they were able to trace this journey historical in a very accurate manner?
I believe that they followed the extremely detailed maps that they drew and their diaries.
Nope. They followed their poop.
I'm sorry. They followed their what?
I'll explain it.
Okay. I need you to explain something to me. So Lewis and Clark, they traveled in the early 1800s, correct?
Correct. They left in 1804.
Okay. So they 1804, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're now in 2019.
Correct.
So we're looking at over 200 years ago, and they're tracking human poop?
Yeah, the math adds up.
I know the math adds up, but the method doesn't.
I'll explain. It wasn't just Lewis and Clark, of course. It was a group of explorers led by Lewis and Clark that had roughly around 30 people in it. They stopped at over 600 sites on their journey, and they did leave very detailed maps of where they stopped. But experts have been able to even get that down closer and more accurate because of a certain medicine that everyone on the trip was taking. And it's kind of funny because this fact that I learned this week kind of goes into the topic overall today. But there was this medicine that was used for a number of ailments in the 1800s. And 17th, 18th century medicine really sucked. And this medicine was called calomel. And even though it sounds like caramel, it is not as delectable. Calomel is mostly mercury. So the entire party was able to, or was taking this calomel medicine for a number of ailments, but it had one thing that it was mainly used for, and that was as a laxative. So it had a name on the street that people like to call it. It was called Thunderclappers because it was so effective as a laxative.
Okay.
Well,
so what was the purpose of them taking Thunderclappers? Why everyone on the journey take these Thunderclappers? That's a wonderful name, by the way.
You gotta love it.
I appreciate it. It's 1700s humor, apparently.
Anyway, the main reason why they took these and why people thought that this medicine was effective is because the mercury was so poisonous that it just killed off lots of bacteria, along with, you know, giving people mercury poisoning. So, you know, being in the...
Well, yeah, but that's a minor side effect. So basically, in order to keep from being sick, they took a laxative the whole way through.
Yeah, it was kind of a preventative measure.
Okay. So here's my follow-up question to why. How did they track them? So, like, did they find, like, fossilized... Did they, like, find their poop? Or did they, like, find the medicine in the plants surrounding them, or what?
Experts have been able to trace high amounts of mercury in areas close to where Lewis and Clark were journeying, so they are able to pretty much dial down where the latrines were dug during these various stops that they made based on the mercury content in the soil.
Interesting. All right, one last question on this. Did scientists go, hey, I bet you we can track it using poop? Or did they just, like, were they testing areas, realized they were close to a Lewis and Clark site, and then just had a hypothesis and tried a couple other ones and realized they were right?
From the article that I was reading, experts kind of knew that the slender clapper being used and knew what was in them. So they were trying to pinpoint some locations of campsites. They were able to use this location to figure out exactly where some of these campsites were.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. It's a weird job to have. That's not a job that I want. But you got to pay the bill somehow, right?
Yeah.
All right.
So that's the story of how experts were able to trace Lewis and Clark's adventures through their poop, or at least the mercury that came out of their poop.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, Anthony, what did you learn this week?
So this week, yeah, so mine is not as crappy as yours, but definitely probably not as interesting, I don't think. All right. So this week, I learned that in the 1800s, if you wanted to be a senator in the South, especially in South Carolina, you were required to own slaves.
That was a requirement?
And the reason is because if you owned slaves, then you were likely, like, you had to, okay, let me rephrase that. You had to own 10 slaves at least. And the reason is because if you owned slaves, then you were more likely to uphold the pro-slavery views of the South, because that was how you were now making some of your money. And it also looks kind of hypocritical if you have slaves and then you start advocating for abolition.
That's insane. So to even qualify to be a member of Congress, you had to own at least 10 slaves?
Yeah, you couldn't be put on a ballot, or you couldn't be nominated by state legislatures if you did not have 10 slaves.
That is crazy. Who instituted that?
I have no idea, but it was the South. So somebody crazy. No, I really don't know. But it was a policy, and it was followed up until after Reconstruction.
Man, that would be like, that'd be like the equivalent of requiring all Republican congressmen or congresspeople to own like 10 guns. So that way the NRA would be like, you own those.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get those talking points in.
Yeah, exactly. That's the exact same idea. And it was incredibly effective. It was incredibly effective, and that's what they did.
Well, let's be honest. South Carolina in the 1800s, there weren't many people that were going to be opposed to owning slaves anyway.
No, and they always kind of did their own thing. South Carolina during the 1800s, like, four or five times, like, threatened secession. And they were like, they told the federal government, like, you do this, we're going to leave. And the federal government was like, oh, okay, don't leave. We're sorry.
Oh, okay. In South Carolina, if you're listening from South Carolina, I don't mean this now, but like during the 1800s, they were just the worst.
Well, so I was doing a lesson on the interactions between state and federal governments this week, and we talked about this one time in South Carolina where the federal government passed a tax, and it didn't directly benefit South Carolina. So they just told the federal government that they weren't going to follow it, and they just basically abolished the law inside the state of South Carolina. And Andrew Jackson was president. He wasn't doing it. So he got a law passed that said that he could march an army into South Carolina to force them to pay it.
Specifically just South Carolina?
Yeah, pretty much. It was called the Force Bill. It would have allowed him to use force to force them to pay the law. And so South Carolina had established this nullification committee. And so the nullification committee agreed to, you know, pay a varied version of the tax. And then, like, right before they disbanded, they nullified the force bill just as, like, screw you, Jackson. And then they, like, all went home, like, just because they could, not because it would have done anything.
Man, South Carolina would buck wild back in the day. They didn't care.
No, they really didn't give a crap what you thought about.
I've listened to another podcast earlier today that was actually talking about one of the your first topic, which was the caning of Charles Sumner.
Yeah.
And I was talking about our good buddy Charles and one of his long speeches that was given. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes that they gave from his speech really stuck with me. And I don't know it off the top of my head verbatim, but it was something along the lines of he was talking directly to South Carolina's representatives. And he said, the entirety of the world would be benefited more if South Carolina had never had existed instead of what you have already given the world.
Oh, yeah. People from the North hated South Carolina because South Carolina was like the poster boy for like slavery and the brutality of slavery. And just in general states' rights and stupidity.
So, I mean, we talked about how Charles Sumner really, you know, let it go in some of his speeches, but we didn't talk about how just like of an absolute burn session that this dude was running for like 15 hours on the Senate floor.
Oh, yeah. And in front of women. We can't forget that. It was in front of women. And how dare he?
Oh, Lord. Not the female constitution.
They can't handle to hear.
I do declare.
Right. They can't handle to hear the word. They can't hear about what happens that they see.
I do declare that man down there talked about a brothel.
Exactly.
Anyway, I think that's enough for what we learned this week.
We need to get out of that.
I think I'm sure we'll return. But this week we have an actual topic and I will be the one that is presenting this week's topic.
I'm excited for this, man. This is going to be... This is going to be very highly educational.
It should be. We are continuing our discussion on the Third Reich, and it was my week to pick a topic to talk about in the Third Reich, and I decided that I wanted to talk about drug use during the Third Reich. Now, I had a couple inspirations for this. Mainly over the summer, I read a book by a German author named Norman Ohler. It is translated into English, so you can read it in English, which is what I read it in.
You didn't read it in the original German?
I didn't read it in the mother tongue. I'm sorry.
I don't want to hear about this.
Nein sprachen Sie
Deutsch. No longer interested.
Anyway, the title of the
I'm disappointed.
The title of the book is called Blitzed, Drugs in Nazi Germany. I thought it was a very interesting read, and it has some really good reviews. It has some reviews from some historians that don't necessarily like the way that he wrote about the topic, but he did a lot of extensive research and kind of dug into some really deep sources. Also got a little bit of inspiration from another podcast that I listen to, a podcast called Sawbones. It's a medical history podcast. You should go give them a listen. If you know the McElroy family, it's Justin, the oldest McElroy brother, and his wife, who is a doctor. And they talk about the history of medicine. And I've been listening to that for probably about a year now. And it's absolutely fascinating to me. It's nice. It's, you know, PG rated relatively like ours. So it's good family listen, and it's, you know, roughly 30-40 minutes, so it's nice snippets. Anyway, that's my those are my plugs for the night, but I wanted to talk about drug use in Nazi Germany. And to do that, we have to go back to the 1800s. We're going to start a little bit earlier because the history of drug use in Germany not just Nazi Germany, but Germany in general, starts way back in the 1800s. So in the 1800s, there were these things called patent medicines, also known as nostrums. Now, patent medicines were widespread throughout the world. You might have more commonly heard them referred to as snake oil. You know, the whole idea of kind of a sleazy.
So patent medicines are snake oil. So that's where we get the idea of snake oil salesman from.
Yeah. So the idea of like a sleazy twirled mustache, you know, top hat wearing charlatan coming in and, and selling, you know, cure-alls. Those are what we would call patent medicines or nostrums. Anyway, so patent medicines were very popular in the United States and in Europe in the 1800s, leading up into the early 1900s. These were generally non-regulated. In fact, most drugs were not regulated at the time, but they generally did not have any sort of regulation behind them. There really, most of the time, wasn't any sort of research behind them or any sort of medical thought put into them.
So you're telling me that the medicine
usually
had no medical thought behind it?
Most of the time, no. Usually these were,
I mean, that makes sense, right?
That's exactly. Well, in the 1800s, to be a doctor, a lot of the times you just had to say, hey, guess what? I'm a doctor.
If I do that today, can I get paid like a doctor or no?
Yeah, no. That,
because if I can't, I'm totally just going to start calling myself a doctor.
Yeah, that's fraud and malpractice and all sorts of fun things. But I mean, in the 1800s...
If I'm not a doctor, I don't have malpractice insurance, and I'm not actually treating anybody.
Well...
I think we can get around this, Steven. I think we can do it.
Semantics, schmantics.
Exactly.
Anyway, but yeah, so like during the 1800s, especially like the American West, some of these frontier areas, you could just kind of roll up and have a little bit of training and be like, I'm a doctor. And people really didn't question that up until kind of the mid-late 1800s. Anyway, so these patent medicines were usually sold as herbal, and I have herbal in my notes in quotation marks, but as herbal cures, usually containing exotic ingredients coming from the Orient, and they were advertised as being secrets of Africa and the secret root of Brazil that the Amazonians have had for ages. Most of the time,
that seems like a stretch.
Yeah, most of the time, these nostrums and these patent medicines and these snake oils, usually sold as a tonic or a potion or sometimes a poultice that you could rub on yourself, didn't really have exotic ingredients. Real ingredients usually included things such as cannabis, cocaine, opium, large amounts of alcohol. You also get things such as turpentine, phosphates, and even after the discovery of radium, you got people selling irradiated water as a sort of cure-all.
Okay, so we're going to kill the cancer. We're going to kill you, but you're going to be so high or drunk that you won't even care about it.
Yeah, so the idea behind these patent medicines is basically make people feel as good as possible and they'll forget that they're sick.
I mean... I'm down.
So a lot of the cure-alls were basically just drug cocktails. But I mean, think of like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola started off as, it was started by a pharmacist in a in his pharmacy, started as a sort of trying to come up with a cure-all, and cocaine, coca leaves, was used in the original formula. Eventually, it was
taken. So it really was used. It's not like this, like, urban legend on how we get the name.
No.
Coca-Cola.
No, it was actually, coca leaves were actually used in the original Coca-Cola recipe, and it was sold as a medicine. Dr. Pepper, we get that because it was invented by a doctor.
Was his name Pepper?
Yeah, his last name was Pepper.
Wait, are you serious? Are you joking?
No, I'm serious.
That's fantastic.
All right. And there was, like, I forgot exactly what Dr. Pepper had in it, but there were definitely some heavy drugs in it. Anyway, so this trend of including very heavy drugs in these medicines and these patent medicines is going to continue up until the 1900s, into the 1910s and 20s, especially even in the United States during Prohibition. An easy way to get around Prohibition is by getting a prescription for some of these tonics, which were just basically cocktails. So you had...
So you're telling me during Prohibition. So during Prohibition, because we had so many alcoholics, you could get a prescription not only for alcohol, but also just take copious amounts of drugs and go on your merry way?
Oh yeah, for sure. There were pharmacies that operated during Prohibition that were basically bars, but they, if you had a prescription, they would make these tonics for you, these tonic drinks that were pretty much just cocktails. Anyway.
Sounds like a good time, man.
It was a good time, supposedly, allegedly.
We totally shouldn't build a time machine. Can we advocate for that?
I'd be down for it. I'd lobby for it.
But just for the research.
Yeah, just for the research. Another drug that was widely popular up until even World War II was morphine.
Yeah, man.
Now, Anthony, what do you know anything about morphine? Do you know where it comes from?
I don't. I know it's a highly addictive pain medicine. And I also know that one of the first morphine rehab centers was in Louisiana. And I think it was in Slidell or Manny.
That's interesting because what we have to say about tonight has nothing to do with any sort of rehab at all. but yes, morphine was morphine was incredibly addictive. It is an opiate. It originates from opium, which by itself is addictive enough. And then morphine is just an even more addictive version of opium. It's kind of like there's some like scientific processing that you have to do in order to make morphine. All right. So morphine was used mainly as a pain medicine. It was used a lot during wartime. During the Civil War is really the first time we see morphine being used regularly. During the wars in Europe in the late 1800s, like the Crimean War and the Boer Wars in South Africa, and especially World War I, morphine was used very heavily. So morphine was used for pain, to treat pain, but it was highly addictive. So people at the time, scientists and chemists, wanted to try and find alternatives to morphine that was less addictive. Now, one of these scientists was a German chemist named Felix Hoffmann. And Felix Hoffmann worked for the pharmaceutical company Bayer.
Right.
Or Bayer.
As in, like, you take...
Now, Anthony, does that name ring a bell?
Bayer medicine to, like, not have a heart attack and stuff like that?
Exactly. So, Felix Hoffmann was actually the same chemist that in 1897 synthesized aspirin for the first time. And aspirin was a trademark of Bayer up until 1919, when they when Bayer had to give away trademarks due to the Treaty of Versailles, and that's when, you know, just the drug in general, aspirin, kind of became the generic name for it.
So we have aspirin because, like, we have access to aspirin because of World War One.
No, this happens before World War One. It happens in 1897.
You know, I'm saying, like, because they had to give the patent away. We, as in Americans, had access to it, I guess.
Oh, yes. Well, we had access to it before, but we have the ability to call medicines aspirin and it not be trademarked.
Oh, I understand. I understand.
Yeah, so the name aspirin was trademarked.
I thought they had like the, I don't know, I don't really know how medicine works, like the recipe for it trademarked.
Yeah, they may have. I'm not really super clear on that.
Okay.
But anyway, but no. And the company Bayer is still around today. They still make aspirin. You can get Bayer aspirin. And it was invented by Felix Hoffmann in 1897. But we're not going to talk about aspirin. We're going to talk about another chemical, another compound that Hoffmann created. And he actually did this 2 years before he synthesized aspirin. So in 1895, Hoffmann is a chemist. And he's working for Bayer. And he is trying to acetylate opium into codeine, which is a less addictive compound that you can make out of opium. Well, during one of his trials, he acetylated a compound. He synthesized a new compound, but it wasn't codeine. It was a compound called diacetylmorphine, or diacetyl. Okay, I'm gonna say it. Three, I got it. It's diacetylmorphine. Okay.
Okay.
So during one of his trials, he synthesized a new compound that was not codeine. It was a compound that he called diacetylmorphine. Now, that's a very long and technical name. And of course, when you're a pharmaceutical company like Bayer, you want to have a name that's easy, that people can remember. So when they go to get it at the pharmacy, They can just say, I want, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Diacetylmorphine.
Yeah. So it doesn't really roll off the tongue. So the head of Bayer's research department developed a new name for the chemical. And he took inspiration from the German word that means strong or heroic. And the German word for strong or heroic is heroisch. So the drug that was invented by Hoffman is the drug that we know today as heroin. So heroin.
So heroin is invented by the same person who created aspirin.
Exactly.
And by the same company that keeps me from having a heart attack at a young age.
Exactly. So heroin is synthesized in 1895 for the first time in a stable environment. Bayer retained the rights to it, and they began to advertise it and sell it over the counter as a less addictive alternative to morphine. It is not true. Heroin is a million times more addictive than morphine.
Because there are a ton of people who are in rehab centers and on the side of the street because of heroin, not so many because of morphine.
Just another aside, you know, another very addictive opiate, oxycodone.
Let me guess, he invented it too.
Hoffman did not invent oxycodone.
Okay.
It was invented by some German scientists at the University of Frankfurt in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
But the Germans have a history, as you can see, of inventing or of coming up with very addictive substances.
So what you're saying is not only is World War II the fault of the Germans, but so is all of our drug problems?
I mean, I'm not going to say that much of a stretch, but
okay.
I mean, correlation does not always equal causation.
But sometimes it's fun to point out.
But sometimes it is fun to point out. So heroin was, from 1895 until 1925, was sold in Germany and all over the world over the counter as a less addictive alternative to morphine. To get morphine, you either had to go to a doctor or have a prescription. To get heroin, you just got to go up and get some.
I mean, that's how it works today, right? That's exactly how it happens today.
Yeah, yeah.
So nothing has changed.
Heroin was actually banned in the United States in the 1910s, but it wasn't banned in Europe until 1925 when the League of Nations was like, okay, there are way too many people that are addicted to heroin, so we're just going to put a stop to this. Now, Bayer, the company Bayer, would later be consolidated in 1925 into a chemical company called IG Farben. Now, if that name rings a bell with you, it's because they're going to become very infamous in about 15 years because IG Farben was actually the company that invented and distributed the gas Zyklon B, which was used by the Nazis in their death camps. So Bayer has a hand in aspirin, heroin, and then Zyklon B gas that was used in concentration camps.
Why do we let them still be a company?
Because after the Nuremberg trials, there was actually a trial for IG Farben, and they were dissolved back into their individual companies.
Mm-hmm.
And Bayer was able to retain its status as a company after World War II.
So we just glossed over the fact that they created heroin. We were just like, okay, cool. Move on.
Yeah, that's not really something that comes up a lot. Well, widespread drug use, heroin dens, were a problem in Germany during the 20s and the 30s. A big issue is that there were lots of World War I veterans that were addicted to morphine and heroin because they had started taking it for pain, and then that just emerged into opioid addiction, which is a lot of the opioid addiction that we see today. It's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, in the 30s, the Nazis take over, and they're going to have a very different policy towards drugs than the Weimar Republic had. And we're going to find out about that policy when we come back from this break.
All right, and welcome back to the History is Fun podcast. We today are learning about the drug use in the Nazi party. And so Stephen was just kind of talking about, the last thing he really talked about was the companies that created heroin and how that started to affect German society with people being addicted to heroin and morphine after World War One.
Yeah. So like I said, in the 20s and 30s in Germany, there was widespread drug use. After heroin was outlawed in 25, heroin dens became a thing. So under the Weimar Republic, there was a very, especially after it was made illegal by the League of Nations, the Weimar Republic kind of had a very strict no-tolerance policy towards drugs. And there were what we would, they called vice departments in police, which were dedicated to things like prostitution and sex work, and drug use was a big part of that vice that these police would go after. Anyway, so when the Nazis take over in the 30s, they're going to change the way that they view drug policy pretty dramatically. The Nazis adopted a very tolerant view towards their drug policy. In fact, many Germans were encouraged to deal with pain and also performance enhancement with drugs.
So basically what they were wanting to do was get people on their side by allowing them to get really, really high? Like that was the plan?
I wouldn't say that that was like the plan. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
But addiction was treated as a medical condition rather than an illegal activity. Now, of course, if you had people that get too strung out or cause, you know, commit crimes while high, that would still be prosecuted. But overall, addiction was treated by doctors. Pretty much most drugs that you could want were available recreationally, or you could get a prescription for them. Now, a big part of the Nazis' support came from World War One veterans that really felt like they were kind of screwed over by the Versailles Convention, which, in fairness, Germany was really screwed over mm-hmm. by the, you know, the Versailles Convention.
Only a little bit.
Only a lot bit. But so instead of trying to hunt down and prosecute these World War One veterans that had been, you know, hooked on heroin, they kind of changed to more of a treatment rehabilitation stance as far as drug use went. But for non-addicts, drug use was kind of accepted. Pretty much the only drug that was looked down upon during the Third Reich was tobacco. There was a very staunch anti-tobacco stance in the Nazi Party. Hitler personally hated tobacco smoke, and the Nazi scientists actually were some of the first scientists in the world to discover that smoking tobacco can lead to lung cancer and other problems, where at the time, a lot of the doctors throughout the world were like, oh yeah, you got a sore throat, here's a cigarette. The Nazi doctors were like, no, that will give you cancer.
Was that seriously a cure for like sore throat? Was here, smoke a cigarette?
Yeah, like in the 40s and 50s, you can look it up. There are a lot of cigarette ads from the United States where it's like, these Marlboros are doctor certified and 9 out of 10 doctors approve of this Camel because it leaves a nice smooth voice or something like that. Anyway, so tobacco usage was very looked down upon. A lot of public spaces were designated as no smoking zones. Also, tobacco use was something that was associated with Jews and Slavs.
There's a real reason.
And of course, you couldn't have the master race being associated with a behavior like that.
Oh, of course not. That would be.
So that also kind of went into the whole.
That would be horrible.
Yeah. So that kind of added to the whole anti-tobacco thing. But other drugs, they were cool. Alcohol was very popular. Of course, the Germans loved their beer and they loved their liqueurs. But drug use was very widespread. And it was also encouraged in the Wehrmacht during and leading up to World War II. Cocaine was very popular amongst soldiers and fighter pilots, mainly because it would keep them alert. But another drug would soon become very popular, and this is going to kind of be the focal point of tonight. So I want you to imagine with me, imagine that you were living in Germany prior to World War II, and you're going to the cinema, you're going to see the newest Riefenstahl film. And before the before the movie starts, ads are going to show, and a sort of modern day drug ad is going to come up on the screen. So imagine an idyllic German village in the countryside, women and girls and during those the men and the boys wearing lederhosen, running and laughing through the fields on the slopes of the Alps. A narrator comes in and says, "Life is good. The Third Reich is the most powerful empire on the planet. Our genes have never been more pure. But even still, the strongest German needs a little pick-me-up every now and then. Introducing Pervitin, the Volk's drug." So
the people's drug.
Yeah, the people's drug. So the drug that we're going to talk about for this portion, that I'm going to kind of focus
on. I really liked your German accent, by the way. Yeah.
And of course, they didn't have modern-day drug commercials in the 40s and 30s in Germany. But, you know, we can imagine.
It's just a nice historical fiction.
Anyway, Pervitin was a very popular drug in Nazi Germany. It was invented by a Berlin-based pharmaceutical producer called Temmler starting in 1937. It was widely available over-the-counter before and after World War II. It was used by everyone from soldiers to housewives, and it kind of became like a cure-all in Germany. And the research I did said that on any given week, Temmler could ship out millions of doses. So whether you had a headache or you needed help staying up to study or you were nervous or you had a stomach ache or whatever happened, you could take Pervitin. Now, Pervitin did a couple things. It gave the user feelings of euphoria, self-confidence, energy, and cognitive spikes. It was very much seen as a performance enhancer. One of the cons of Pervitin, one of the side effects, is that it could cause insomnia.
Yeah, that would make sense along with what it does.
Yeah. Pervitin was used by soldiers during the Blitzkrieg of Poland and France, and it was so popular in the military that both in the military and in civilian life, it became known as either Stuka tablets. Stuka is a type of a plane that was flown during World War II, or they were known as Hermann Göring pills. Yes,
because he was over there. So it was
very popular with pilots of the time of the Luftwaffe. But even though it was mainly supplied and made for the military, it was also widely available to the public, and you had people that were taking Pervitin throughout the time before World War II, leading up to World War II, and even during World War II. It was kind of seen as the thing that kept, you know, as part of the total war, you got to be alert and you got to be ready in case something happens to fight for the fatherland, and Pervitin will help you do that. Now, based off of the effects that I went over, you know, euphoria, self-confidence, energy spikes, cognitive spikes, what do you think some of the main active ingredients in Pervitin were?
I'm not incredibly sure, but it sounds very similar to cocaine. It sounds very similar to like LSD, speed, like those kinds of drugs.
Okay, yeah. The main active ingredient in Pervitin is a drug that is very popular today. And again, following heroin, this is another drug that was invented by the Germans. The main active ingredient in Pervitin was methamphetamine.
Oh, that's so good, man.
So for about 8 years, from 1937 until 1945, a vast majority of, or a large chunk of the German population were taking daily doses of meth pills. Meth tablets, 35 millimeters.
So daily doses of meth, because that's how we measure our meth intake now, is just daily doses?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this was over the counter. You could just go up to a pharmacist and be like, "I would like some Pervitin." "Sure, here you go." And tobacco bad, meth good.
So tobacco bad, meth good.
So Pervitin was very popular. One of Pervitin's biggest proponents and biggest users was Hitler himself.
Sure, why not?
Now,
that makes sense.
Hitler was very much into drug use. He suffered from a large number of ailments for a very long time. He had tremors. He suffered from an irregular heartbeat, stomach pains, insomnia. After the failed assassination attempt, his eardrums were bursted, and that caused headaches, kind of chronic headaches for the rest of his life. So Hitler was not what we would call a healthy man.
It's hard to be the leader. It's hard to be the Führer.
Yeah.
Like you need a little something to help you out.
It's a stressful job.
For sure. I mean, you got to run not the free world, but you know, the world.
Historians have suggested that Hitler had many different diseases, some of these including syphilis, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease. Now, the thing about these claimants is that most of these are theories and are unfounded. You know, these are kind of theories that historians have based off of the way that Hitler acted in certain situations and firsthand accounts of Hitler. But we don't have any actually medical diagnosis that says that Hitler had any of these diseases. But I mean, if you go back and watch newsreels from the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, and that was kind of a huge chance for Germany to really get their, you know, get their vision of what they thought Germany was out to the world. So there were video cameras everywhere. You can look at footage of Hitler at the 1936 Olympics, and the dude's twitching like super hard.
And it totally wasn't because he was on meth, right?
Yeah.
It was because of a disease.
I mean, it's not. Google this, look it up. You can just look up Hitler at the Hitler shaking at the Berlin Olympics. And I mean, it's not a normal thing. Either he has something physically, medically wrong with him that is causing him to shake, whether that be Parkinson's or syphilis or something, or he's definitely on something, because the dude is straight up twitching or tweaking. The dude's, I can't, just look it up. Anyway, nevertheless, in 1936, Hitler appointed a German doctor named Theodor Morell as his personal physician. Now, it started off because he was recommended to Hitler from one of his advisors, because he said that his doctor had saved him from gangrene back in World War I. So Hitler, taking the advice of his doctor, of his friend, took on Theodor Morell as his personal physician. And his role as physician very quickly turned into what we would call a Dr. Feelgood.
He was a drug dealer.
That's pretty much what he was. A couple things about Theodor Morell that I found to be interesting. He was morbidly obese and unhygienic. A lot of the inner circle around Hitler complained about his table manners and his body odor. Hitler is said to have responded to these claimants, "I do not employ him for his fragrance, but to look after my health."
I don't care what he smells like, as long as he gives me my meth. Shut up and walk away.
According to one source, Hermann Goering called him Morell der Ritzspinnenmeister, which is the Reich master of injections, basically because he had a tendency to overprescribe medicine.
If you're allowed to give drugs to Hitler, you might as well allow him to overindulge.
Yeah, so as all of these different ailments begin, you know, keep popping up, he keeps prescribing medicines to Hitler from 1936 until 1945. He, at its height, he would have Hitler ingest dozens of pills, give him multiple injections daily. Now, Hitler kept him on because he was convinced of his medical genius. At one point, I think Goebbels was sick, and Hitler said, "Oh, well, go see my guy. He's good." And Morell gave Goebbels what he said was a packet of vitamins, but Goebbels didn't trust him. So he brought it to a chemist to have it checked out. And basically, it was full of meth and other drugs and what he said was vitamins.
So is meth not a vitamin? Because I was always under the assumption that it was.
I don't know. Maybe where you're from it is, but I wouldn't consider it. They're not making Flintstones meth tablets.
I bet you the Nazis did.
Gummy meth.
I will put money on it that they made that.
All right. So one of the interesting things I found was that Morell, the reason why we know that Hitler was on all of these drugs is because Morell kept a running journal of all the care that he gave to Hitler. So here is just a short consolidated list of some, not all, of some of the different compounds that were given to Hitler throughout the care under Dr. Morell. First up is Altrapa Belladonna. Hitler would take 2 to 4 pills with every meal for a total of 8 to 16 tablets a day. Now,
what was that?
Altrapa Belladonna. It has another common name, which is deadly nightshade. It's a poisonous plant.
And he would take how much of that with every meal?
8 to 16 tablets a day.
Holy crap.
Atropine, which is a medication used to treat certain types of nerve agents and pesticide poisonings, as well as slowing the heart rate and decreasing saliva. Bromide, almost a spoonful of bromide every night, which was used to counteract the stimulation from all of the methamphetamine that he was taking, which would allow Hitler to sleep. Caffeine injections, chamomile, because when you're the Führer, you just need to calm down sometimes.
Well, that and when you're taking not only tons of meth, but also caffeine pills.
Yes.
You have to have a chance to relax.
Eye drops that contained cocaine and adrenaline. For his upset stomachs, he would give Hitler enzymes as well as samples of the E. coli bacterium.
For what purpose?
For his upset tummy.
Yeah, but like what would that... Giving a guy who's incredibly sick, why would you give him samples of E. coli?
You know what? That is a great question.
That's like... I don't even have a good comparison for that.
Okay, the next drug was a drug called Eucadol, which was just the German name for oxycodone. So we got that covered. A drug called Papaverine, a drug called Melteformin, which today is used as a diabetes medication. Pervitin, and another drug called Vitamultin, which of course we know is methamphetamine. Morphine.
So he was taking two kinds of meth?
Yeah, two kinds of meth.
Because one isn't enough.
Just straight up morphine. Yeah, no. You gotta cover all your meth bases. Jeez. Just straight up morphine, a pill called Multiflor, which were pills described to Hitler for his flatulence, oxidrine, tartrate, potassium bromide, phenazone, different proteins and lipids, sodium barbitone. This next one's fun. Strychnine. Just straight up strychnine. Sulfonamide or sulfa drugs. Testosterone, as well as various vitamins. So
was that like over the course of time, or was that like in one day?
Well, by the end, close to the end, that is pretty much the chemical compound, the drug cocktail that Hitler was being ingested with or taking every day.
How did he have time to do anything else? Like,
you know, that's a,
how do you have time to even, you know, think about, maybe that's why they lost the war, because he was too busy getting high.
Well, most historians would agree that towards the end of his life, Hitler began showing signs of being heavily addicted, and he died probably as an addict, probably even was going through some symptoms of withdrawal when he committed suicide.
Really?
It's Hitler, so there's no sympathy for me there. That's just...
No, there's no sympathy, but at the same time, like, that is an incredible amount of drugs to ingest in one day.
It's like the scene from Parks and Rec where Ron Swanson wants all the bacon and eggs.
Yes.
Except this time it's Hitler and he wants all the drugs.
And he knows what he's about, son. Like...
All right, so Morell is going to stay on with Hitler throughout the war. He was actually even allowed into the Führerbunker in Berlin during the Battle of Berlin. According to some sources, he was actually the one that administered the cyanide tablets that Hitler and Eva Braun and Goebbels and his wife used for their suicides.
And let's not forget Goebbels' six children.
Yes, and Goebbels' six children. They gave the children the cyanide tablets and then took the cyanide tablets themselves.
Yeah.
When they knew that the Soviets were closing in. Anyway, just a few days before Hitler committed suicide, he was released by Hitler. Morell was released by Hitler, told that he didn't need him anymore, that his medical care of him was at an end. So Morell escapes. He was captured by Allied soldiers in May of 1945. He was interrogated. One of his interrogators was, quote, disgusted by his obesity and lack of hygiene. He was sent to an American internment camp at the former site of the Buchenwald concentration camp. He was questioned because of his close connection with Hitler, but he was never charged with a crime. And then Morell went and died in 1948, being grossly obese and suffering from very poor health. He died in a hospital in 1948. And that is pretty much the tale of drug use in Nazi Germany. It's kind of a good analogy of a populace that is being hyper-fueled by methamphetamine only to crash and burn spectacularly.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, you've got a group of people that are angry and you put them on lots of meth and then you tell them it's all somebody else's fault and they're just gonna,
yeah.
I mean, they're just gonna kind of go for it, you know? I do think it's interesting, though, that like Hitler didn't partake in alcohol.
No, he was a very strict teetotaler.
Oh, yeah. And he was, you know, against, like you said, he was against tobacco. And in most areas of Hitler's life, he was incredibly moderate in like
most of the things in his life. He was a vegetarian, you know, he, but then this is this one, you know, in this one strange area where he just couldn't control it like he could in every other aspect of his life.
Well, I mean, there was the whole mass genocide thing.
Well, I'm talking, yeah, all right. You know what? We weren't, I was trying to, yeah, whatever.
Anyway, no, I know what you,
I don't have any, you're absolutely right. Aside from killing lots of people and drugs, he was able to do everything else in moderation. Is that better, Steven?
But yeah, no, so, I mean, we have this idea of the Nazis and their idea of this racial purity and wanting to be the strongest and the most pure. And there's the posters that you see of the super muscled up Adonis types that were supposedly the proto archetype of your perfect German. But then in reality, they're all hooked on Pervitin. It was, I won't say it was the driving force, but yeah. When you give a bunch of soldiers meth and you say, all right, we're going to go and do some lightning war in Poland and France.
It helped.
It helps out a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The Japanese use drugs to help with their kamikaze pilots. Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the Americans use drugs as well to give courage to their soldiers?
Oh, yeah. Drug use and fighting. Drug use and soldiers have gone hand in hand for a very long time. We talked about...
I mean, you talked about in your William the Bastard episode whenever... You talked about Viking berserkers using mushrooms to give them, you know, godlike abilities.
Yeah, so giving what we would call performance enhancing or even psychotropic drugs to soldiers before battles is something that humans have done for a very long time. And we are just now, in the past 20, 30 years, coming to grips with that. A lot of the heroin epidemic and a lot of the homeless populations that we have here in the U.S. are ex-military. These are vets that have come back from war and have unfortunately been exposed to opiates, mm-hmm. whether that be through painkillers or whatever. And for the longest time, and even still, the government really doesn't do anything really to help with that. And that's something that in the future that we are going to really have to take a lesson from and realize that, oh, this is something that we've been screwing up for a very long time. And this is something that we need to work on.
Oh, absolutely. And it'll be something that our kids are going to have to be the ones who are going to have to figure out how to fix the problem.
Yeah. And I would hope that we as a young generation can hopefully come up with some solutions that our kids don't necessarily have to deal with that.
I agree. I'm also kind of pessimistic, I guess.
That's true, and it's easy to see why. Yeah. We, our generation, you know, those of us that were born between, you know, 85 and 95 would be extremely pessimistic.
The dreaded millennials. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Anyway, last thing I want to say about Pervitin is that it was actually still available for a little bit after World War II. It became a popular street drug in the late 40s and 50s, especially in East Berlin. So it stuck around for a little while, and now we have crystal meth. So I think we got the good end of the bargain.
So we're doing better.
Well.
Right. It's totally not destroying communities.
I guess if you want to boil it down, we wouldn't have the show Breaking Bad if it wasn't for the Germans. So
we're doing better.
So I guess we can.
So at that point, do we get to say yay Nazis? Can we say yay Nazis, or is that still not okay?
I still don't think that's okay.
But like just for that one thing?
No.
No. So, okay. Even just for the Breaking Bad? Yeah. No. All right. I wasn't saying any Nazis. I was asking a question, obviously.
All right. Well, it is late. I have a little bit more lesson planning to do before class tomorrow. So I think that is going to end us for tonight. And yeah, we are just out of time.
Yeah.
Well, Anthony, it was a pleasure being back.
I like it.
Yeah, this is a great comeback.
I've missed you, Steven. I have missed you. For sure. Hey, can I have one quip?
Yes, please quip.
Just to sum up the whole thing.
Quip away.
Don't do drugs, kids.
Yes, we should have probably put that disclaimer in at the very beginning. Actually, I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to say...
Nope, we're going to do it at the end.
Here's a disclaimer for this episode. Don't do drugs.
Don't do drugs.
So I'm going to leave that in at the end, but I'm also going to put that in the beginning. Anyway...
Leave it at the end where no one will hear it.
All right. So I think that's going to be it for us at the History's Fun podcast. Anthony, why don't you tell the lovely listeners who are from all over the world now. We've got
I saw somebody.
Yeah, we've got some from from Belgium and Spain, and we've got some people in Mozambique listening, and I saw some India in there and Bahrain. I mean, we're going international, baby.
Yeah, we're getting those accidental clicks all over the place.
Those accidental clicks are great.
They make us look so
much look. We'll take any any clicks, whether accidental or on purpose, we will take them.
Exactly.
So, yeah, Anthony, why don't you tell the lovely people where they can?
You can purposefully find us on Twitter at History is Fun Pod. You could email us at historyisfunpod@gmail.com. You could even go on the Anchor app and leave us a voicemail so that we can put it into the podcast and we can answer your question or address your comments. You could and you should leave us a review on Apple Podcast. And as always, if you have any suggestions, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, please let us know so we can address them. And if you have any suggestions for new topics, we're always in need of those. Let us know so that we could expand our topic field.
Great job, Anthony.
I appreciate that, man. I needed that in my life.
All right. Well,
Stephen, thank you for teaching us about being blitzed in Nazi Germany.
You're very welcome. Yeah. And go check out the book Blitzed, Drugs in the Third Reich by Norman Ohler. You can buy it online. You can get it in a library. Check out the Sawbones podcast and give those a listen. But for us at the History of Sword podcast, I am Stephen.
And I am Anthony, and we greatly appreciate y'all listening.
And remember, don't do drugs. Really, really, don't do the drugs.
They're not good, no matter how much Hitler liked them.
Yeah, no bueno. All right, and that's going to end us for tonight.